There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So here's a story 4.5 billion years in the making. It's the story of an asteroid called Bennu that may end up on collision course with planet Earth. And if it is coming this way, we should know more about it. So in 2011, NASA gave Dr. Dante Loretta, a planetary scientist at the University of Arizona, $1 billion to send a spacecraft to the asteroid and bring back a sample. And Dr. Loretta takes us through the very human endeavor to bring scientists together and pull off an expedition that helps us understand our place in the universe. His book is called The Asteroid Hunter: A Scientist's Journey to the Dawn of Our Solar System, and Dr. Dante Loretta joins me now. Hello.
Hello, Jesse. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, nice to talk to you. Before people panic, I'll give them the date, September 24th, 2182. That is the date in, what, by my maths, 156 years or so, when Bennu and the Earth may collide. How big is this asteroid and how dangerous would a collision be?
Asteroid Bennu is about 500 meters in diameter, so about the size of a skyscraper. I like to think of it as a small mountain in outer space. And you're right, the impact, if it's going to occur, it's way in the future, and the odds are generally low. It's about 0.057% chance that the asteroid will hit the Earth in the late 22nd century. So I don't want people worrying about it. It's a small risk with a big consequence, so we think it's worth investing some amount of resources in order to understand it better.
Out of interest, do you know how that one compares to the one that wiped out the dinosaurs?
The asteroid Bennu that was the target of our mission is much smaller than the asteroid that struck the Earth 65 million years ago and correlates with the extinction of the dinosaurs. Bennu, if it were to hit, would create a regional disaster. It would make an impact crater that's about 5 kilometers in diameter. So it would take out a city-sized area, but it wouldn't be an extinction-level event that would affect all life on Earth.
Uh-huh. But we would probably know about it.
We would definitely know about it. It would ruin your day if you were there. And it would be like globally, like when a massive volcano goes off and you get a lot of dust in the air. Sometimes you get spectacular sunsets, but the climate is often affected. So there would be global impacts and effects of the asteroid crashing into the Earth, but it would be primarily the damage would be within hundreds of kilometers of the impact site.
By the way, they're not the topic of the interview, but I notice you're quite careful about talking about the meteor that coincided with the extinction of the dinosaurs. Are we not 100% sure that it was the cause?
It's hard to be 100% sure about something that happened 65 million years ago,
yeah.
Right? I mean, definitely a large asteroid hit the Earth right around that time, and it didn't make life any easier for those organisms. But there's a lot of other research. There was large volcanism activity going on and other climate influences. So it's a complicated system. It's almost certainly the asteroid played a large role in their extinctions, but there were other factors at play. And scientists are still looking at the nuances of how does a species go extinct? Can it happen on such short timescales? And how do global effects from an impact ripple through the ecology?
Yeah, gosh. So, and asteroids do hit the Earth all the time. I think we just discovered the most recent one to hit New Zealand. Why did we need to go to this one?
Well, we talked a lot about the asteroid impact hazard, but I'm more interested in what you started with, the 4.5 billion year old sample. I'm a geologist, basically, and I study rocks and I tease their stories out of them. They hold on to their histories. And the rocks that make up this asteroid represent some of the very first rocks that formed in our solar system they were in place before the Earth existed. And we chose this asteroid because it's very dark. And we postulated that that low reflectance surface implied high carbon abundance. And in fact, we have proven that to be the case. And it also has abundant water locked up inside its minerals. We look at these kinds of carbonaceous asteroids as the bringers of the ingredients of life, the water that's in the oceans on the Earth, the molecules that's in our atmosphere, and even the organic material that makes up all living things. We believe they originated from asteroids like Bennu. And when we collect and return samples to the Earth, those are the questions that drive most of our research investigation.
Did you feel a personal sense of destiny working on this incredible mission to land a spacecraft on a moving asteroid and scoop up a sample?
I did. It still amazes me. Even though I wrote a book about it and I lived that life, I still am in amazement that I actually got to lead this mission and be part of this great adventure. And I evoke some of those feelings in the book. There's an underlying story of these two carbon atoms that were formed together in the heart of a star. One of them's in the asteroid. One of them's in me, and they're trying to get back together. Mm-hmm. And the inspiration for that was this compulsion that I felt to continue to push forward to make this mission, first of all, a win. It had to be competitively selected by NASA, and there were a lot of other teams that wanted this opportunity. And then to just push through all of the challenges that we faced. And this was not an easy job. The asteroid I called the trickster. It was constantly, in some cases, literally throwing curveballs at us. Particles were flying off the surface we observed short after we arrived.
You, and I want to get to that. I just wanted to mention, too, that you grew up in what you describe as a chaotic childhood, and it would be understandable if all you were focused on as a kid was happiness in the household. So, but what was your entry into big dreams about the universe?
Yeah, I grew up in the middle of the Arizona desert, and by a single mother with two younger brothers. And we didn't have a lot. We didn't really have a television for most of that time we were out there. And so the desert was my entertainment and my adventure. And I was an explorer and I loved finding hidden treasures. There's a lot of old mining operations in Arizona. I would dig through the tailings piles looking for the ore, a little piece of treasure that had fallen by the wayside while they were processing. And I got really interested in the people that were there before me. I would come across Native American ruins and their petroglyph walls. And I started to wonder, who was here before them? And how far back can you ask that question? There has to be a beginning to it at some point, I think. And that drove me, my curiosity, my love of nature, my appreciation for the history recorded in geology. All of that kind of culminated in becoming a planetary scientist and then an astrobiologist and really thinking about the origin of life and how it took hold on this planet and how likely is that to have happened anywhere else in our solar system or in our galaxy or the broader universe.
And this job, as you imply, was not easy. You need a couple of things. At least you need the ability to imagine what's possible. And then you need the tenacity to make it happen. And did you sort of discover these qualities or discover anything about the qualities, those qualities within you during this process?
Yes, I definitely plumbed the depths of my own psyche leading this program. And there were many times I thought about I wasn't going to be able to do it. I wasn't going to be able to handle it. It was too much pressure. I wasn't originally the principal investigator, which is what we call the leader of a NASA program like this. I was the deputy. I was the scientist. I moved up into the leadership role after my mentor passed away too early. And I learned the value of teamwork and trust and building a cohesive vision. I think that was really what led to our success. And I felt it. I was part of something much bigger than myself. And it was my job and my responsibility to keep moving it forward, keep the team with their eyes on the prize, and to also feel like they were part of something really special. And for me, that is what pulled us through those most challenging periods, the darkest days of the COVID pandemic when we were doing our most intense operations at the asteroid. It was that sense of we're doing something amazing. and historic, and we're just going to push through and get this job done.
People who know the classics in ancient Egypt might feel you were tempting fates by naming this mission what you did.
I think the mission named after Osiris is very appropriate because Osiris has a dual nature. We've talked about the asteroid impact hazard, the extinction of the dinosaurs, which led to new life and species like human beings. And we also talked about the origins and the seeds of life. Osiris has that same dual nature. When you see him, he's got green skin. He's associated with agriculture, probably brought civilization to the Nile Delta. So in a very real way, brought the seeds of life to that part of the world. But he also became the god of the afterlife. He was resurrected after a brutal death and led you to the next stage of your existence after you passed away. And so I felt like that dual nature was really adequate and captured the scientific objectives of our program.
I'm speaking with Dr. Dante Loretta, a planetary scientist at the University of Arizona. His book is called The Asteroid Hunter, A Scientist's Journey to the Dawn of Our Solar System. And Dante's job was to send a spacecraft to an asteroid and bring back a sample. And what's the hardest part of that, Dante? Is it the science or is it the human factors? Managing a team of people who are incredibly smart and I imagine pretty opinionated too.
Without question, the human management, the human system was the most challenging part of the mission. We said it often, the science and the engineering are the easy parts. Keeping a team, in some cases, we grew to over 500 people working on the program. Keeping that team unified, keeping the morale high, keeping the communication flowing, keeping our eyes on the objective and avoiding scope creep and cost overruns, personality conflicts, people being not in the right position. Very talented people, but they just weren't assigned the right job. So I always looked at it like a puzzle. Where do they fit? I know they've got value and I know they can contribute to this mission success, but they're not in the right role right now. How do I get them in the place where they can succeed? So I was always looking, shifting. I was often the translator between different technical groups. Science and engineering speak very different languages. And I had to be the one that listened to the scientists and then translated it to the engineers so they could actually build this amazing spacecraft.
So take us back to the day of the launch. I suppose you don't allow yourself to feel anything but optimism about how that day will go.
That is true throughout the entire program. You always have to be optimistic. There's, as we say, a million things that have to go right. And if only one thing goes wrong, you lose the whole program. And launch was a transcendent day for me, literally. I was exhausted. The days and weeks leading up to it were a flurry of media and interviews and university gatherings, alumni, fundraisers. So I was on all the time, and that wears you down. And then, of course, you're stacking your beautiful spacecraft, which we had just spent the past 5 years designing and building, onto a giant pile of explosives. Less than 1 week before we launched, a rocket right next door exploded on the launch pad and almost took out our mission because of the plume of black smoke. If it had flowed across our rocket, a lot of contamination would have been deposited and we wouldn't have flown.
Yeah, there was a SpaceX
one.
I had
seen in a very real and visceral way how these things can go so terribly wrong at the last minute. So all that was in the back of my head. But by the time we got to launch day and I was seated at my console and I had all the telemetry coming across, I was at peace because I knew we had done everything possible to make this a success and our fate was now in the hands of the universe. I made sure to enjoy it. And when that main engine lit and that rocket lifted up into the sky, I went with it. It was like an out-of-body experience.
Gosh.
I felt like I was going into space with OSIRIS-REx on that journey to the asteroid Bennu. And back.
And is that countdown? Is it just like the movies?
Yes. It starts pretty early. The movies don't show you how the countdown starts a day before. So there's all kinds of things that are kicked off, right? There's weather balloons that are flying, and there's just an enormous amount of activity. I still have the launch book, which has every step of the countdown. But at the end of the day, absolutely, it's just like the movie, 10, 9, 8. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Actually, between 3 and 2, the main engine gets lit. And that's kind of when I lost track of the count. because it was that's when the rumble starts and the fire and the flame, and you're just in the moment and you don't care what the number is. You know you're
Gosh.
going at that point.
So you've got the challenge of getting the spacecraft there, and then the separate challenge of figuring out where to land it. And people will be surprised that at this point of the story, we welcome the entrance of legendary guitarist from the band Queen, Sir Brian May.
That's right. He has a nice cameo in my adventure. That's been a fantastic friendship and partnership, a dream come true for me. I have a T-shirt. They're celebrating their 55th anniversary next year, 1970 to 1955. I was born in 1970, so I've literally been listening to Queen my whole life.
Yeah.
They were one of my favorite bands as a kid, still listen to them all the time. And then right after we launched, I got a congratulatory email from Brian May. And I thought I was getting punked. I showed my wife. I was like, this can't be real. Like, wow, I'm getting a rock star, one of my heroes is congratulating me. And we started chatting back and forth, and he'd been to Tucson, Arizona, and loved it here. We had some nice dialogue about the region. And then I figured I would never hear from him again because he's a super busy guy and he's moved on to his next thing. And then we arrived at Bennu and we started posting images on the internet, and he would take the images with his collaborator, Claudia, and make stereo images out of them, where he finds two images that are just offset at the right angle. And using one of his stereoscopes, you see the surface in beautiful 3D. And it changed my perspective of what this asteroid was like and what we were dealing with enormously to get that view. It's like putting your glasses on. And so I emailed him back and I said, this is amazing. Can you make more of these? Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, he said, let me know. And I said, do you want a job? And he said, yes. So we brought him onto the team, and he really appreciated that. He appreciated being treated as a scientist, playing a critical role in our sample site selection. And we ended up putting a different book together. There's a book called Bennu 3D that came out last July that captures all those beautiful 3D images that he produced and all of the maps that we made. And it's really a nice visual tour of the asteroid.
Fantastic. And you hinted at this before. What tricks did that asteroid throw at you as the spacecraft got closer to the surface?
Well, first of all, the general nature of the surface was stunning for us in not a good way. We had done a historic telescopic astronomical campaign before we launched. We had convinced ourselves that the surface was smooth, that the particles were small on the order of centimeter scale, maybe even sandy-like material. Mm. And that there would be an abundance of choices on where to go and get just the right sample off the surface. And then we arrived, and the surface was rough and rugged and covered in giant boulders with no beach in sight, nowhere that looked like there was accessible material. Our guidance accuracy, that is the tightest spot that the navigation engineers thought they could get us into, was 50 meters across. When we got those 3D images from Brian, the best we could find was maybe 10 meters, and everything looked like 5 meters or less. So we had to change the capability of the spacecraft, writing new flight software and beaming it across the solar system so that we could get into those really tight locations and ultimately collect that sample. Yeah. And that was just the first surprise. We went into orbit on New Year's Eve 2018, and within 5 days, we saw the surface of the asteroid erupting. Particles shooting off into space. It was a moment of sheer panic because we thought we were in danger. These were bullets flying off the asteroid's surface. They were going to take out our cameras or our solar arrays or rupture a fuel tank. And it took us a few days to realize, and this is where microgravity really messes with your mind, everything is moving so slowly that there's no risk to the spacecraft. But it didn't look like that. It looked like a volcanic eruption, where instead it was just like tiny little flakes breaking off a cracker kind of energies that were involved. So we were like, yeah, we can take a hit from one of these things. We designed the spacecraft to go down and punch the asteroid in the face and kick up a bunch of rocks. A tiny particle in orbit around the asteroid is not going to be a challenge for us. So it quickly morphed from crisis into cool science opportunity.
Yeah, there was another moment where a large stone got jammed under a protective cover of yours. I'll let people read about that. But mission accomplished, really, to that point, and then it would be 2.5 years before the spacecraft can return to Earth's orbit to deliver its payload, September of last year in the Utah desert. And how were your anxiety levels?
It was unbelievable. It was so stressful because you spend all of your time training, rehearsing, practicing the worst case scenarios. So your mind is on all the things that are possibly going to go wrong and how you're going to deal with that. It's hard to picture the nominal scenario where everything goes according to plan, because you're like, that's the easy thing to do. What are we going to do if the parachute doesn't open? What are we going to do if the battery catches on fire? What are we going to do if it's pouring rain and we're operating in a mud pit? And none of that happened. It was a beautiful day. Everything worked, more or less. Parachute opened up. Capsule came down for a gentle landing. I can tell you, when I woke up, my fitness tracker said my heart was racing at 120 beats per minute, which is about over twice what I normally have upon waking. So I was stressed. And I knew at that point, almost 20 years of my career had been invested in this program, and it could all be lost with one malfunction. So the stakes were enormous. The whole world was watching. One of the other things we spent a bunch of time doing was rehearsing the TV show. I think we spent more time on that than actually rehearsing recovering the sample. So there was this enormous camera presence. I was on all the time, tons of interviews, tons of media. Similar to launch, but 100 times more intense because everything was on the line. The whole program, 20 years, hundreds of people, and the world watching us as it all plays out.
I'm so pleased it went well. And does the sample brought back help us answer any of those big questions you set out to ask?
Yeah, we have an amazing sample. Everybody is so excited. And let's go back to what we were interested in. So we talked about the origin of our oceans. This asteroid is about 9% by weight water. And that's all locked up inside clay minerals, which can hold on to it to much higher temperatures. It's almost 5% by weight carbon. 90% of the carbon is in organic molecules. Some of those organic molecules are the same ones used in biology, particularly amino acids, which make up our proteins. Life uses 20 of those. So far, we've detected 13 of them. Nucleobases, literally the letters of our genetic code. There's four of them in DNA. Three of those are used in RNA, and then there's a fifth one. We have found three out of the five letters of the genetic code in this asteroid. We see little globules that look like drops of oil, but they're hollow inside, kind of reminding me of a protocell, maybe, at least a compartment where interesting chemistry could take place. And it's early days. We're really just getting started. I know the sample's been on Earth for months now, but it took us a while to get into it. There was some stories about our challenges getting the sample accessed and then getting it distributed to the team. So we've got our first set of reports out, but it's the best times are ahead of us. It's an astonishing sample. It looks like it's from a very wet, maybe even ocean world, something like an icy satellite of Jupiter or Saturn, loaded with organic chemistry and a treasure trove of information about the earliest stages of solar system formation. And I think giving us some important clues to origin of life. And what gets me most excited is if those compounds are on this asteroid, not only would they have been delivered to the Earth, but Mars would have had them, Venus would have had them, the outer satellites would have had them. So the chance for life to originate exists on those other planets. Whether or not it did is still an open question. Either way, the answers are profound.
And I guess, bonus, your story and your books and the coverage will have hopefully inspired plenty of other young people in your area and in America and around the world to go into this beautiful area of science and help us understand the origins of humanity and the origins of the universe even better.
Yeah, thank you, Jesse. I think the real reason we invest in these kinds of missions, we have great science, great engineering, amazing stories, but it's the inspiration. That's the thing I appreciate the most, and I see it every day. I'm a professor at the University of Arizona. Students are so excited about the mission, just being a tiny part of it. The students now are getting to analyze samples, so they get into the labs and they get to do all the fun stuff. But all through the program, students have come to me and said how inspirational it is. And I hope others take that to heart and go do something amazing. Follow your dreams. The universe is infinite in its mystery, and our time here is short, so don't waste it.
What a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much. I've been talking to Dr. Dante Loretta, a planetary scientist at the University of Arizona, and his book is called The Asteroid Hunter, A Scientist's Journey to the Dawn of Our Solar System. Dante, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jesse. It was my pleasure.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.